The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now, what role can AI play in the future of medicine? Health researcher and author Dr. Charlotte Blees believes it's time to be engaging in conversations about AI and its use in healthcare. And her new book is called Dr. Bot, Why Doctors Can Fail Us and How AI Can Save Lives, examines the limitations of human judgments in medicine, emerging uses and shortcomings also of AI, and how our imperfect medical systems can let us down. Charlotte, good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you. This book is a very, very interesting book. We want to talk about diagnosis, first of all, and how errors arise.
Yeah, so diagnostic error is actually more common than we might suppose. Between around 5 to 20% of doctor-patient visits result in a misdiagnosis. And some experts who work in the field suggested the number might be even higher than that.
And there's a very interesting stat you give me in the book, which is about in people who die in intensive care, 40% of those who died, the doctor in charge was 40% of them were absolutely certain they had the diagnosis right and they were wrong.
That's it. And that's a real problem, because often when we talk about human judgment, doctors can be very certain. They talk about the art of medicine, but actually the art of medicine is quite a vague supposition. It's sort of going with your gut instinct. But gut instincts can be wrong a lot of the time, and it's very hard for doctors to know when they've got it right and when they've got it wrong.
You explore other areas like medical burnout, be it doctor or nurse, that when they get burnt out, they're attention to, if you like, the diagnosis and treatment may...
It can start to slip.
Suboptimal.
Absolutely. Even when doctors are depressed, there was one fascinating study. When doctors are depressed, they're six times more likely to commit to make medical errors, with medication errors. So doctors are increasingly burnt out. Patient numbers are soaring. We're living longer with more chronic illnesses. So burnout remains a sort of persistent factor in our current health systems.
There's something that an old pal of mine, no longer with us, Dr. Austin Darrow, used to say when he was going through medical training, that his professor said to him, the most important diagnostic instruments you have are your ears. Listen. Now, in your book, you point out that only 50% of GPs, and in the terms of consultants, only 20%, ask the patient when they walk in, why are you here?
This is a problem. So doctors tend to interrupt patients quite a lot. So often think that they're quite good communicators, unfortunately, sometimes there are communication breakdowns. And it's quite difficult for them to listen persistently without trying to hurry the patient on. But actually, studies show that when you actually let the patient speak, they get to the end of the sentence and they will divulge what's wrong. But there is this sort of disparity, if you like, this power imbalance within the visit. And that's partly because we're consulting with an expert. And that can be intimidating for people. They tend to be more embarrassed, more fearful, and they don't like to ask too many questions of their doctor.
And they also won't tell the full truth.
Yes, people are literally dying of embarrassment. And that sounds sort of hyperbolic, but they are. People delay, particularly with embarrassing symptoms, socially sensitive symptoms, mental health conditions, people delay going to speak to their doctor.
The question of time as well, and we know in the NHS, which used to be the gold standard, if you wanted a GP, you made a phone call or you popped into the surgery and you got seen. That's no longer the case. So you may be waiting weeks for a GP appointment. And then when you get there, you mightn't get the time that really is required.
It's an ongoing problem. It's getting worse. Waiting lists are getting worse, including, as you said, in rich countries. The situation is even more dire in lower and middle income countries, getting medical attention fast, or even just getting information.
Now, we thought that there might be a revolution brought on by the pandemic, that telemedicine might become the thing.
Yes. Well, telemedicine, the uptake was absolutely rapid in a way that had been delayed for many decades, really. Sort of since the 1990s, it was recognised that telemedicine was viable because people had internet connections, most people had a home computer, or many people did in a lot of countries. But there was this sort of postponement of progress.
Mm. And people, of course, now can have very accurate thermometers. They can take their own temperature. Many have smart watches, so they can actually not alone monitor their heart rate or whatever, they can actually pass that information on digitally to their doctor.
Yes, that's increasing all the time. And I talk in the book about a case of a patient who was diagnosed with his Apple Watch with a heart condition and got there quicker than the doctor. So people are becoming better equipped and more knowledgeable about their own health conditions.
Now, what's that the thing about consulting Dr. Google? It turns out most people do, even before they go to the GP. They want to get a kind of an insight into what might be wrong with them. What do doctors think of that?
It depends. There's fascinating studies that show that many doctors welcome it. And by the way, doctors use Dr. Google as well. I have colleagues who told me that they leave the room when they want to use Dr. Google. But doctors avail of all of these tools as well. But sometimes they can be a little bit fearful. But many doctors do welcome it. But patients do, you know, patients are using these tools, and they're using newer generation tools like ChatGPT as well to search for information on their symptoms.
Which is, of course, the AI, and we'll be coming to it.
Yes.
AI in a moment. But telemedicine, some doctors embraced it during the pandemic and maintained it. Others, as soon as they were over the pandemic, dismissed it out of hand. I mean, that's a problem. And it's all about their own comfort, isn't it, rather than about the patient's need.
It can be, unfortunately, it can be. And I think for understandable reasons too. I mean, doctors are very busy people, and culture change is really difficult in medicine, but that's sort of the point. Humans are just bad at culture change, particularly whenever they're burnt out and they're working in pressurised environments.
But the idea that someone has to go to see the doctor, and they might be on crutches or whatever, and they might have to hike from the car park and hike up the stairs, three flights of stairs, all because the doctor up at those three flights of stairs is comfortable there.
Well, this is it. And in the sense I discuss in the book, sort of the legacy structure of actually visiting a bricks and mortar hospital or clinic. And that tends to lead to an observation that what's called the inverse care law, which means people who are most in need of healthcare tend to be the people who face the greater number of obstacles. So whether you're elderly, you've got a disability, people with low incomes.
Where are the hospitals built by and large? In better areas?
Yes. And not every area is going to be an epicentre of particular medical specialty. I mean, Boston has something like 17 major teaching hospitals. Not everywhere's like that. So there's sort of the contingencies of geography and history.
You also have some analysis of how patients are treated by race, by class, by age.
Yes, age tends to be overlooked as well. And also the symptoms that people present with. Some symptoms are sort of a bit more boring and more tedious for doctors. And behind the scenes, they acknowledge that. So there's sort of a pecking order of symptoms and conditions. So certainly how we present can interfere with the time that our doctor spends and their clinical judgment.
So moving to AI medicine and how it might work. Well, the first thing is, there'll be no time constraint with AI. I mean, if you have to fill in a questionnaire, you can take all day if you want.
That's it. You can wake up in the middle of the night and check. Use these tools from your pillow. It's more convenient. You can search for information. These tools don't get burnt out or depressed. They don't need to take a break to take a toilet break or whatever. So, which is a burden on doctors too, incidentally. Yeah.
Also, you might be honest with it. Like, how many units of alcohol do you take? How many cigarettes do you smoke? How much exercise do you take? You with a human being, you're kind of trying to gild the Lily, maybe?
Definitely. I mean, there's lots of evidence that patients, and we've known this for decades, that they pour their hearts out to machines. That can be good in terms of extracting medical information, that we tell more. On the other hand, we're divulging rather a lot of sensitive information to these.
And there have been hacks, of course, and people have to be careful that their information might be hacked. Although, if it turns out that so-and-so has a particular condition, does anybody really care about it? You know, insurance companies might.
And this is the issue with technology. It's the further profiting and exploitation in a whole variety of ways, depending where you live in the world, of your sensitive medical information, whether that affects health insurance, employment, a whole range of issues.
Now, the question of what AI can do that the regular doctor cannot do, and one is, keep bang up to date with all the research?
Absolutely. I made a calculation a couple of years ago that a new biomedical article is published every 39 seconds. If doctors were to read 2% of the relevant material, it would take them more than 22 hours a day. Machines just don't suffer from that problem. And that's before you've even committed it to memory and it's useful information. So machines can keep up to date and abreast of information. But of course, and as I say very loudly in the book, they're not without their own problems either. They can make errors. The question is, are the errors worse, more egregious than
humans? I mean, you talk about perfection being the enemy of the good.
Yes.
Even with machines, because what they do is they look at AI and they'll compare it to the very best doctor in the world at diagnosing and say, well, the AI didn't quite get it right.
This is a problem. And actually, humans tend to hold AI to a higher standard than they do other humans. So there is a sort of inbuilt human-centric bias there. But look, if these tools can be more effective and more accurate, I think we're going to see people gravitating to using them.
Now, they say that you can maybe detect cancer more quickly using AI. You can detect dementia, Alzheimer's more quickly using AI. And one example that you give is endometriosis, where it might be missed by a doctor for decades.
Yes. About 1 in 10 women suffers from endometriosis, but there are very long diagnostic delays. In fact, the studies on it are quite, they're not that many, but in the States, the average wait for a patient with endometriosis is around 9 years, which is a long time to be suffering. But studies show that tools like ChatGPT can get to the they answer the questions 90% of the time accurately and can get there much faster. And that's also important for people who have rare illnesses as well. 1 in 10 of us has a rare illness. Again, people wait for decades, which, you know, is a long time to be suffering, and perhaps being the suggestion being that suffering is all in your head, or which can happen.
Now, the question is whether these robots can be judged based on the inputs. For example, you give the example of the IBM computer Watson, which took on Jeopardy and won. But the question is, what background does that robot have? Who gives it the input, the medical knowledge, or does it simply scrape the entire internet for its information?
Yes, this is an issue. So how these tools are trained, similarly to with humans and how they're trained, that's going to be a key issue moving forward. What are we feeding the machines? How are they trained? How are they tested? But I think there's opportunities here in ways that are more challenging to retrain doctors, if you like, human beings.
The final question really is about if we do embrace AI in medicine, and there's no doubt we will in so many ways, who will control it? Will it be the big tech companies who have control of medicine the medical institute?
These are huge sort of societal and political questions. And they're things that I think we've got to think about now and not postpone any longer. Critical questions.
It's a terrific book, and it asks and answers all of these questions in great style. It's called Dr. Bot, subtitles Why Doctors Can Fail Us and How AI Could Save Lives. And its author, Charlotte, please. Thank you very much, Charlotte, for joining us in studio today.